stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Emmy Award-winning, Peabody Award-winning, Tony-nominated playwright, screenwriter, lyricist, Sherman Yellen. As you can hear, Sherman made a life with the written word. But he started off his life believing he was going to be a fine artist, a painter. Listen to the way he discovered the writer inside the painter and made a life that began with stories his mother told him about her life and the lives of her extended family, and how he developed from writing stories about his own life to writing the stories of our lives. So stay tuned. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
about self-discovery. If you've been listening to the show, you know that I am a psychotherapist and that the theme of the show, the intent of the show, is to point out that while we come out of childhood with very definite feelings, ideas about who we are, it is my experience as a therapist that for most of us, maybe even all of us, it isn't the complete story. What we came to believe was true about ourselves may very well be true, but as I said, not the whole truth. I talk about this as having created a cover story. I believe that to some extent we recognize that there are qualities, behaviors, ideas, ways of being that don't fit either with our family of origin, with our peer group, with our school, with our community. And because we are so flexible as children, and because we only really have one agenda as children, and that is that we should continue to be accepted so that we can be kept around, because we know quite well that we're going to die if we're not. So we have radar for those things which somehow are acceptable to our system. Now, I try and make this point over and over again. It doesn't mean that they always like what we demonstrate, but somehow this is what they expect from us or want us to be. So you see really smart kids acting dumb because they got teased for being a smarty pants or a wise ass by a parent who in their own family was discouraged from being too smart and feels threatened by the emerging intelligence of their child. So one wouldn't think that intelligence could be discouraged, but in fact it is all over the place. So you can see that qualities that are really valuable can become difficult to maintain, and therefore children will hide them. Even health. In a parent who desperately wants someone to care for may very well discourage robust health or active life and encourage illness by only really caring for the child, seeming to love the child when the child is hurt or sick or sad or in some kind of trouble. So you can see that whatever it is that I'm just going to talk about the family of origin here, because that's the primary source, right? That whatever it is that the parents seem to require of the child is in no doubt about what that is. And we all, to the extent that we are able, supply what is necessary. In psychotherapeutic terms, this is called helping to establish homeostasis, balance in the family. This is essential to the functioning of the family, and children know this instinctively, and they do whatever it is that the family requires in order to achieve this balance. The problem, as I'm sure you can see and have seen if you've been listening to the show, is that what we kept hidden as children may very well be something we badly need as grown-ups. Maybe the thing we need. And when we get there, we can't find it, because we not only got successful at hiding it from others, it just became too cumbersome to know about it ourselves. So we learn to do, again, what psychotherapists call denial. Denial is a gift our unconscious gives us. It puts a blanket over these things that are too dangerous for us to know. So I have seen people in my office who think they're ugly when they are actually beautiful, who think that they are cowards when there's a long history of very courageous acts. You know, the truth is not what we use to decide who we are. So the theme of the Lynn Show, the intent of the Lynn Show, is to make this point, to encourage whoever is listening to ask themselves, is there a quality I very much want, which it is in maybe even possible that I already have? Is there something I hid? Is there a story about me as a child that people tell and laugh because it's not true of me now? Am I aware of hints of this that come up but I quickly squash because they embarrass me or scare me? So just to begin to ask the question. If you want more information about this, I talk about it in some of the shows, as I am talking about it now. I wrote a book about it called When You Can You Will What... Oh, good, I forgot the name. I wrote a book about it called When You Can You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can get access to the book, even here the first chapter, by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, S-H-O-W, thelynshow.com. The book, audiobook, workbook, all can be gotten up there. If you have questions you want to ask me, there's a place to email me. Just ask me whatever you like. And you can hear all of the interviews that I have done. They're all up on the website. And speaking of interviews, the other thing I do with my show is to air interviews that I have done with people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because it is so difficult to dedicate a life to an art in our culture that, at least in the area of their work, these people are just who they are. And you hear it over and over again. You hear the resonance. The what you hear is what you get. The synchronicity of themselves with their work. The in-syncness. And it's always my hope that as you listen, you will be asking, what is it that I'm out of sync with, perhaps? So, the interview today is with writer Sherman Yellen. Sherman is here in Sarasota, Florida, because the West Coast Black Theater Troupe is currently producing a version of his musical, Blackbird, the Josephine Baker story, for which he wrote the book and the lyrics. And I want to encourage you to run on down. It by the time this show that you're listening to airs, it will have been, Blackbird will already have opened, but I know that they're extending it because it's sold out. So please allow yourself the opportunity to come on down and hear it. Sherman is a wonderful example of what I want, the point I want to make with this show, because he started out life thinking of himself as one thing and then discovered something else to which he has given his life. And that, of course, is the point, that there can be things about us that we have not been readily aware of, and which, if we can find and access them, can give a fullness, a depth, a joy to our life, which we previously were unaware of. So you'll hear all about that from Sherman. Before I play the interview with Sherman, and after I play the interview with Sherman, I'm going to play a few songs from Blackbird to give you a taste. So I'm going to stop talking now, and I'm going to play a song called Cinderella Me, which might be a kind of anthem for Josephine, and then the interview with Sherman Yellen.
I got the cinders, I got the ashes, I got the hard life, don't know where the cash is. Someday there's gonna be me, a princess. So what do you think? It's Cinderella me. I'll get the pumpkin, I'll get the horses, I'll be the hot meal, the full 20 courses. Just look and you're gonna see a slip that fits like gravy and grits. I won't call it quits. That's Cinderella me. No Prince Charming's gotta be the one who steals. cinders or get the ashes. I'll tell your mama I wear the flashes. And someday there's gonna be that princess in pink dragging her mink. So what do you think? It's Cinderella. Come watch me, Bella. It's Cinderella.
I am here with Sherman Yellen in his guest apartment in Sarasota, Florida, and he is here because West Coast Black Theater Troupe is doing a performance of his play, Blackbird, the story of Josephine Baker. Did I get it all right?
You got it absolutely right.
Okay, great. All right. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the art to which you have given large chunks of your life is playwright?
Yes, which means that you interview very few people.
Oh, no, lots of people have given their life.
Yes,
not necessarily
a living,
that's exactly right. But lots of people, you'd be surprised.
Yeah. No, I do.
And lots of people who have given their life have not made a living, but...
They try.
That's right.
And they hope.
And they give their life to it anyway.
Yes.
Which is the point, right?
And
I only ask one question. And I ask the same question. When was the first moment that you suspected, knew that writing, that words, that stories would be something you would give your life to?
I went to the High School of Music and Art in New York.
Oh, okay, but wait. If you went to the High School of Music and Art, there must have been something that happened a lot earlier that suggested that you might want to go to the High School of Music and Art.
Yes. Yes, but not as a music student. I was painting.
You were painting?
Yes, I was a fine artist. And I went there, and I was pretty good, but I realized at that time that I would never get past a certain point. Even as a young man, I knew there were limitations to my ability.
Okay, I'm really curious. Did you start to paint as a four-year-old?
As a child, yeah.
As a child, you started to write?
I think I needed praise too much, so I was technically very good. But there's a moment in every art form when you have to break with the notion of doing something for other people's good words, and you do it for yourself. And I, as a painter, I can never get beyond that.
Yeah, I really want to talk about this, about the idea of doing something for yourself as opposed to what other people are telling you. But I'm curious, you were supported in your idea that you might be an artist?
Yes, I had very good parents.
And
I was one of the fortunate few who my parents said, whatever you want to do, we're behind you.
Yeah.
And so that was terrific.
So you had pictures of yours on the refrigerator and on the walls and on the...
They didn't have... When I was growing up in the 1930s, they didn't have magnets to stick on refrigerators.
Right.
We had refrigerators. I think we called them ice boxes.
But did you still have the ice out on the...
No, we were a little beyond that. But
I remember that from my grandmother.
She called it an ice box.
Yeah, right.
That's true.
Okay, so did you have crayons? Did you have pencils?
I had crayons. I had pencils. I also had asthma, which meant that as an asthmatic child and as a small child, there was very little I could do. There was no real good remedy for asthma at that time. They didn't have the inhalers and all that.
So it was
bed rest.
Right.
And as part of the bed rest, I had something I used to call it. Mama, give me something to lean on, which meant a board, some crayons, and I would just draw and draw and draw and draw.
Yeah.
And also, my mother was a great reader, and if I think the literary thing came, the fact that she read to me all the time, even before I could, read for myself.
Yeah. I understand. Do you remember any of the early stuff she read you?
Yes, I remember Pinocchio, because it was a wonderful edition of it. That this is the pre-Disney Pinocchio.
Yeah.
My God, I lived in a pre-Disney world.
Who would have thought?
That's dating me, isn't it?
It was a book, and it was illustrated?
Yeah, and she read all the fairy tales, and we read the Arabian Nights. In the very censored version that was made for children.
Yeah. Okay, so lots of imaginative fiction.
Yes.
Right?
Imagined eviction went into my upbringing.
Right. And also you had the graphic sense, the picture sense,
yes.
Right? Okay, so you think you're going to be an artist, and you get into music and art, which is
yes.
not a foregone conclusion. Not everybody gets in.
That's true.
So they must have thought, did you have training as a child in...
No, I was a natural.
Wow, okay. Okay, so you get into music and art, and you start having classes.
Yes.
Right? And you start to see, what, other people's work, your...
Other people's work.
How do you make this distinction... that it's not good enough?
Well, because in a curious way, it was too good.
Mm.
I think that's one of the problems that people who are precociously good
mm-hmm.
have. You reach a certain level as a child, whether it's an artist or as a performer, and that level has brought in a lot of satisfaction.
Yes.
But then there's a line, there's a ceiling. And if you can't go beyond that ceiling, if you can't break with that level of competence
yes.
and try new things. And I've, in an odd way, I tried it, but I wasn't very good at getting beyond. I was a good draftsman. I could draw with ease.
Yeah.
But I knew my limitations. I had a very good understanding of what they were.
This is so interesting to me because I think a lot of people would have kept at it, would have kept trying to make that thing give them what it used to give them. Do you understand what I mean?
Well, yes. What it used to give me and what I have tried to find in writing and often do is, this sounds very pretentious, but a kind of out-of-body experience where you are so committed to what you are doing that you forget about you and all the problems that you have and everything you're doing is absorbed in the act of creating something.
Yeah, I don't think it's pretentious at all. I think it's wonderful and also... much to be desired, and in this case, we were talking earlier about only the few. I think that is something that everybody doesn't get. Even people who give their lives
yeah.
to a work are not able to achieve that sort of oneness with the work that that everything else ceases to exist, and it's you and the thing,
yeah.
and you are the thing, and the thing is you.
Right.
Talk about pretension. Okay. So here you are in the High School of Music and Art. You have thought until you were 18 or 20 or whatever it is that you're going to be a fine artist.
17 months.
17, okay, fine.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, damn, no, I don't think this is going to work for me. So how did you find writing?
Well, I started doing small stories based upon my experience as a child.
In school?
In school, in music and art. And they were published in the various yearbooks. And
oh, so right away. So you've discovered immediately that you had a facility.
And I found it gratifying. I did. And I liked self-examination. I always have.
Mm-hmm.
That could either be a fault or a virtue. Because one can become self-absorbed if you think too much about yourself. On the other hand, I was very interested in who I was, where the world was around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a sense from a very early age of being a terrific observer, not necessarily a commentator on my own life, but I could see the world around me and was interested in the dynamics of my family.
Another blessing is not the word I want, but another good thing that you got from the asthma.
Yes.
You know, because you were forced in a way. So you either had to look out or you had to look in, but you had to look somewhere, right?
Yes.
Because
yes.
you couldn't go out and play ball.
Right.
Right, right. Well, so a lot of advantages, that's the word I wanted, an advantage. It's interesting that it served you, the asthma, in a lot of ways.
Well, I think it served me in a curious way, even with Josephine Baker, with this project.
Mm, tell me.
Because asthma makes you an outsider. Illness makes you an outsider.
Oh, yeah.
In your own world, particularly if you're a child. And I began to understand outsiders in a different way. And that included African Americans
mm-hmm.
and anyone who seemed to be disadvantaged.
Yes.
And so I
or anybody who wasn't like everybody else.
Yes. And it was a unique experience for me. Music and Art was in Harlem. And
right.
that was one place where I felt very comfortable and very much at ease. I mean, look, I cannot replicate the African American experience. Everything is unique. But what I once said to a reporter who said, what's an old white guy like you doing writing about Josephine Baker? I said, this old white guy writes about women, and I'm not a woman. I can you know, we have such a thing as called empathy and imagination.
Well, and there's something else, I think. I think that you're speaking to it. Let me see if I can say what I'm thinking. That there is a universality of experience. If you have an experience as a human being, and someone else has an experience as a human being, the fact that they don't share your color or your economic status or your sex or whatever it is, doesn't diminish the fact that you have had the same essential human experience that they have.
Yes, I truly believe in, corny as it is, that we all have this human connection. And so in a sense, we know each other in ways that we often don't think we know each other.
No, you know, Jung's collective unconscious.
Yes.
We're all in it together, essentially.
Yes, and it explains the diversity of religion and everything, and the similarities.
Yes.
You know, we're the rite of spring,
yes.
Easter,
yes.
Passover, what you will.
And the Celtic.
Yes.
I mean, it's all the same,
yeah.
Right?
All of us Druids.
That's us. Yes. Okay, all right. So, in music and art, were there classes in writing, or you just, again, began to do the thing you do in a...
I don't think there's such a thing as classes in writing.
Well, but you know what I mean.
I really believe there are classes in reading, and reading intelligently, in looking, not replicating other people's work, but beginning to probe and critique and really begin to love literature. Mm-hmm. And from the earliest age, I love good writing.
Yes, and this goes back to your mother and the reading.
My mother and the reading, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so were there classes at music and art that helped with that? Or?
I don't think I ever had a writing class in my entire experience.
So what were you doing in music and art?
I was painting. I was painting, and I was taking all the subjects that you had to take, you know, history, geography,
right.
Mathematics.
And then on the side you were writing little stories.
Yes, I was writing little stories.
Amazing.
Many of them about my family. And
write what you know.
Write what I know, except I never showed them the story.
No.
God forbid.
No. It just reminds me, this has got nothing to do with anything, but I don't know if you know who Stuart Kaminsky was. He was a mystery writer. He lived in town. And I interviewed Stuart, and he told me, Stuart started writing when he was an infant, essentially, and never stopped. And he would hide his stories in the house. He didn't want his parents to find them. And when he was 7, he hid a story under the couch, and it was a story about his neighbors that he made up. He'd made up the story that his neighbor stole something, and his daughter found him, and his mother found the story and was furious at him. "You're saying these terrible things about our neighbors. You must never do this again, you know." But Stuart didn't listen and continued to
write.
And he wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. Right. Exactly.
Except in my case, I've finished a memoir that I had been writing for a long time. I think I had to wait 20 years until the last death, which was my sister's death, before I felt I wanted to publish it, and then because I wanted to look at it with dispassion, the lives that we had all lived, and the time that we had shared and lived through.
And not to have to worry about what someone else would make of it if they were reading it.
Yes, because, you know, every memoir is, to a certain degree, there is such a subjectivity to it that I remember I published one part of the memoir about my grandfather and the World's Fair, the 1939-40 World's Fair, and meeting him there and what he was like. He was called Little Grandpa, my father's grandpa, who was a Brit. And some cousin from somewhere read it and said, "That wasn't the way he was." Well, that's how he was to me, and that's how my family perceived him. And so I really didn't want anything of that, of the people who knew these people. Not that I was going to malign them in any way, but I wanted to write with an accuracy and a subjectivity.
Yes. A
personal accuracy, mm-hmm. which is a little different than a photographic accuracy.
No, definitely. And I don't know, maybe this isn't accurate, but the pleasure is in the self-expression. Not necessarily, you know, writing what was, but writing what was for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and to a great degree, some of it is an homage to my parents.
Yes.
Who were extremely different and very difficult. But the name of the book, which is going to be out in the fall, I think it's by something called Martin Sustainable Press, is Spotless. And it has more to do, not with my character, which is very stained, but it has to do with my mother's kitchen floor. And her conception
you
of what made a good
person. You could eat off it.
You could eat off it. What made a good person? Well, the housekeeper, she was spotless. Someone else was spotless.
Yeah.
And then I began to look at the world as a very spotted place, but it's an
But it's a context, right?
It's a context.
It's a context
of that
in
world.
Which to see everything. That's great.
No, and honestly, in the case of my mother, who I write about a great deal, it's coming out of a world of great poverty and doing it in a way that people at that time were very judgmental. She was a model. She's very beautiful. And to be a fashion model in 1916 for a girl who was raised as a Jewish woman was not considered a very nice thing.
No.
So when my father came along, I think she was very happy to get out of this particular business.
Right. And back into a life that made more sense for her.
Yes. Yes, which was a domestic life, which is what she wanted.
Right.
Yeah.
But that would also, all that stuff would inform you.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, it couldn't help it, right?
Yeah, because one of the wonderful things about having a mother who was very beautiful and smart in her own way, but she had absolutely no imagination. And that allowed me to hear stories that I would have never heard, because when I was what was known as a picky eater. It's hard to say today, says he as he pats his stomach. But being a picky eater meant that from about the age of 3 or 4 onward, she would tell me stories about the family and about relatives who had lived the most extraordinary lives, and uncensored stories, because she didn't think I quite understood it.
Oh.
And yet she was unable to really adapt them. She was just telling me the truth.
Right.
And they stuck with me.
Yeah. This is where all that stuff comes from.
Yeah, I have one story in called Cousin Ida, the Whore of Minsk. about Cousin Ida, who was actually a prostitute in Russia, and who married one of her customers and came to live an extremely respectable life. I remember her when I was a child, because she was always trailed. She had a cigarette with a long holder. And she was always smoking. Nobody knew anything about tobacco at that time. In fact, she gave me my first cigarette because I had asthma, and she thought that smoking would be very good. it would clean out my lungs.
Yeah.
But she was trailed by these puppies. She had no kids. She had these 3 dogs, and she would come. And she was she made upholstery, and the upholstery she made slipcovers, and I remember the slipcovers always being too large. Because she always allowed for a little shrinkage. And I figured that's my memoir. You make it a little too large and allow for a little shrinkage.
Yeah. It's great. Okay, so it's clear, anyway, where this comes from. You get out of music and art.
Yes.
What do you do?
Well, I went to Bard College.
Ah.
And Bard was a very progressive school
in
the late 1940s. And I had some teachers. Some professors who weren't that much older than I was. You know, they had people in their 20s,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the late 20s, early 30s, and they became both friends and mentors to me.
Mm.
And they treated me as an adult, had adult expectations of my work,
right.
And I tried to fulfill them, and I learned a lot there, a great deal about reading and writing.
Yeah, but you also got the... I don't know that, I want to say accolades, but that's not exactly
I got affirmation.
Mean. Right, that's the word I wanted. Thank you, affirmation, right.
Yeah, and I loved the experience. I was there for 4 years, met my wife there, and we have been married ever after.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we're one of the rare people.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Okay, so did you know you wanted to write plays, or you...
It was quite accidental. I wrote a short story, and I had a friend... Peter Stone later went on to become
Peter Stone.
A notable writer. He wrote Charade and several other movies, and then he wrote 1776. And we were classmates. And Peter, who died a few years ago, I think I was attending Columbia University at the time, and he read a short story of mine. He said, "Hey,
you went from Bard to Columbia?"
Yes,
to get out.
I was going to teach.
Ah,
It was this seemed the only outlet for me.
Yeah.
And Peter read the story, and he said, "Hey, that's terrific. We can do a television script of it." So we sat down, and he wrote a draft, and I wrote a draft, and we worked on it together. And he had a stepfather who was an agent, fortunately, and they sold it to CBS, Studio One. So I was writing for television when I was 20 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
And it began the career. Peter and I worked together for about 6 months, and then we separated. We each had our own notion of what to do.
But you were launched.
I was launched, and then I started writing plays, and I wrote a play which was done at the HP studio, which was fun, and submitted it to a competition. And it was read by Hallmark, and I won the Hallmark Award for television drama. And they gave me an assignment, and I started writing for them. And my career as a playwright, scriptwriter, was launched.
Right.
Very early. And I think it was kind of wonderful, because in the 50s, it was possible.
Yes.
For people to break into an industry.
Well, and it was the talent. Industry itself was pretty new.
It was in its infancy. Mm-hmm. I was writing for live television,
right.
Which in itself was a phenomenal experience. That particular piece that Peter and I wrote, there's a funny story that goes along with it.
Anyway,
it was a Civil War drama. And it was about two Union soldiers who were guarding a Confederate prisoner. One of them wants to go out that night, it's the night before Gettysburg, and meet with a girl. And the other one wants them to guard the prisoner. Well, there were two actors. One was Jack Lord, who went on to Hawaii Five-0, and a guy who died too early named Gerald Saracini. And the whole idea was that the guy who wants to go out with a girl lures the soldier to try to escape and shoots him.
Oi.
So that he can...
So he can have a date.
So he can have a date. Well, the whole idea at the end of the show was that Saracini, who played the kid who did this terrible thing, breaks down and has an understanding of what he has done. He looks at the consequences of it. And he weeps, and the camera comes in on him. Well, this is live television.
Right.
And Jack Lord is waiting there. We never saw it. This is never done in rehearsal. Pushes Saracini out of camera range and starts sobbing and goes into the camera. And so that it became, not only did it screw up the script, but it focused all the attention on Jack Lord.
Oh!
And that is why one of them went on to become a star.
Yes, and the other one died young.
And the other died young, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was my first lesson of sort of staying, I love actors, but I stayed a reasonable distance from them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, and it worked for him.
It worked for him, yes. I'm not advising anyone else to try it. You'll get fired.
Well,
in today's world.
Right. Wow. Well, you couldn't pull it off in today's world. They'd say cut.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Start again.
It went on.
Oh, it's great. Okay, all right. Okay, so so you are a writer for all seasons. I mean, you write in every venue. No, that's not right. In every genre, right?
I don't see the distinctions as being...
No, right.
Although I find that, strangely enough, I think playwrights, from time to time, can write prose well. And I find that sometimes writers, novelists, have a more difficult time making the transition.
To fiction. To playwriting,
because playwriting requires listening through dialogue. You don't have the ability to describe a scene as a playwright. I mean, you put it in your notes, but it all has to come through the dialogue and through the personalities, the characters themselves.
You know, this is apropos of not, but early on, I was writing lyrics.
Yes.
And I was writing with a composer who said, there's nothing to writing lyrics. You can write, anybody can write lyrics. And he wrote that he was very, very smart. He did the Times crossword puzzle and all that stuff. He had lots of language. And I remember he wrote a lyric in which the words, the vermilion cotillion, came up. I wanted to say, you know, that's really not singable, the vermilion cotillion, you know. But people think that because they can do one thing with language, they can do another thing with language, and it's not really true.
Well, the art of lyric writing, which is something that I took up really late in life, I was always a librettist. I wrote the book to the musical, and someone else did the lyrics. And I was always discontented in a way, because I really wanted to continue and get into lyric writing. And then I had an opportunity through a very small grant to do a new musical, and I invited Wally Harper, who I had known as an accompanist for Barbara Cook, and I knew he was a good composer, even though he had not done too much with him, to come into my world, and we started writing together. And the one thing I learned was a respect for simplicity, something that I didn't have before. I remember one of my close friends is Sheldon Harnick, who wrote mm-hmm. Fiddler on the Roof, mm-hmm. and I worked with Sheldon mm-hmm. on two shows. And I always used to say, oh my God, why are these lyrics so simple? Well, because it's hard to do it.
Yeah.
It's harder to be simple.
Right.
Because simple is easy to sing.
Yes.
And it's easy
and
to hear.
And it's understand. And it's easy to understand. Right. And
whenever I would get too complex, Wally would kind of slap me down. So there are, I think you'll find in Black very, very few Vermilion
cotillions. Yeah. I remember. I'm thinking, oh, Joe. You know. Okay. So let's get to, let's get to Blackbird.
Sure.
Because that's what got us together. So tell me how that, when did you come up with that? What started that?
We wrote a musical which was done at the Berkshire Theatre Festival, and it was called Say Yes Then. Later we changed the title, I'm always changing titles, to This Fair World. And it was about the World's Fair. The 1939-40 World's Fair, which made a tremendous impression on me.
Little Grandpa.
Yeah, Little Grandpa. Also, it developed in me a passionate love for modern architecture, which is very strange. But I did, because this was, that World's Fair was like The Wizard of Oz. It was like Oz itself. Mm. It was the first time that you saw a conception of what the world of tomorrow would look like. They were very wrong. You know, there are no cars going around, at least to my knowledge, in 39-40, they thought that automobiles would be just go on a road and driving themselves.
Right.
And that kind of stuff, you know. Very few of those fantasies came through, but the idea of simplicity, of beautiful buildings came through. I got off on this tangent. Where was I?
How you wrote Blackbird.
Oh, Blackbird. So we worked on this show, but it was about the fair, and it is a challenge to take characters who do not sing and make them sing naturally. I think we met the challenge to some degree, but I wanted to do a show with a show business background, but I also wanted it to be more than just about a singer. And the one thing about Josephine Baker that intrigued me was her world. This was a girl who between the ages of 14 and, I say, 20, totally uneducated, who at 14 was singing and dancing for pennies in the streets of East St. Louis, which was the worst ghetto in America at that time, and living through the race riots and a horrendous Jim Crow, educated herself, went into vaudeville, and became an icon.
Yeah.
And it was an enormous transformation. And I love stories about people who transform themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about most musicals that I question is you have a character. Funny Girl is a wonderful musical, but you know very little about Jewish life.
Right. Or her life.
Or her life and her background
right.
from that.
After Sadie, you don't
know. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It's all about showbiz.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted something that also had to do with the interaction between my main character and the world mm-hmm. she came out of and the world she was going into. And I hope we've succeeded, that you'll be able to tell.
Yes,
when you see
okay.
the show.
And actually you should say, so it's running from April 20th to May 13th. Okay, so if you call and they tell you that it's sold out, don't worry, because there'll probably be added performances, and you should definitely come down and see it. Okay, I only ask one other question, and actually it's what we've mostly been talking about, but if you have something to say specifically about this, it's philosophical. And I'm sure, I mean, I know you are.
You're scaring me, Lynn.
I know. What are you talking about? You're a philosopher.
Well.
Whether you call it that or not. It just, having given a life, and you have really given a life to art, is there anything you want to say about what that's like? What it means to you? Any thoughts?
Well, you know, it's a roller coaster ride. And it's not, there are wonderful peaks and there are valleys.
Mm-hmm.
But that's true of virtually every life. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think there are uninteresting lives. I don't think the fact that I had written for the theater and I met certain personalities that other people don't necessarily meet has made my life that more fascinating. Everybody's life is interesting if you look at it deeply. And that's, you know, that's part of living with other humanity.
Okay, so...
But about my own life?
About your life in terms of giving it to an art?
Well, you know, if I had it to do over again, I would do it over again. Maybe with some difference, because I feel like I spent a great deal of time in doing commercial work. I had a family. Mm-hmm. That doesn't always blend with being an artist, because they're a financial... I put two kids through college. And that required that I did not spend as much time writing for the theater as I would love to have spent.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have dedicated my entire life to it.
Okay, so of
because
course...
that's where the real satisfaction as a writer comes in. I mean, yeah. I go to a live performance, as I do when I go to see a rehearsal of Blackbird, and it's thrilling.
Yes.
I've never gotten that from a television. There are no thrills. There are paychecks,
which
I don't condemn.
No,
But the thrills are part of the process, because really it is process, and there is a respect for writers in the theater that does not exist in the other media, unless you become a writer-producer, which I never was.
Yeah.
So I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. And at this point in my life, when I am not in what the French call my first youth, it's very invigorating. It's a wonderful thing to have in one's life. And I'm very glad to be here in Sarasota and to be a part of Blackbird and to watch its process.
Okay, that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Sherman.
You're very welcome, Lynn. Mm-hmm. Very welcome.
It's a roller coaster ride. There are peaks and there are valleys. And you can't always do what you want to do, even if you've given your life to writing. You may have to make a living. You may have to write things which you would prefer not to write. Even though you know that writing for the theater, being in the theater, is thrilling and what you would want to give your life to. So we're listening to a man who knows who he is, knows what he would have liked to have given his life to, and was lucky enough to give it to that much of the time, and even when he couldn't give it to theater, to give it to writing. And we're listening to a man who had the courage to say, even though I'm very good at this, I'm not going to be good enough at it, and to explore what else there might be for him, to allow his impulse to write, to flower, to flourish, to pursue that. And when the possibilities arose, when people said, write this, he said, okay, and found himself in it. I hope that you hear in Sherman Yellen's life and in him the rewards for being willing to look inside yourself and find who's there. As I have said any number of times, it's not that simple. And it's not always about an activity. I know I always interview people who make their living or their life with an art, but it isn't just a behavior or an action or a career that I'm talking about when I'm talking about looking inside and seeing if you can find a person there who you have overlooked, an attitude, a way of thinking, an ability, a characteristic, a quality. And you may actually be demonstrating this quality and not be aware of it. Other people may have teased you. Listen to those teasings. Ask yourself, could this be true of me? Could I really be like that? It's not always easy to find, and when you have found it, it isn't always easy to access. So I will remind you again that if you have questions about this and you want to ask me about it, you want to talk about it, You can go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and click on Email Me and ask me your questions. Or you can get the book and read about it all by yourself. Or you can listen to other shows. I often talk about how one accesses an undercover quality, what the dangers might be in discovering and accessing an undercover quality. But now, before I end this show, I'm going to play another song from Blackbird, the Josephine Baker story. And this song is called Bad Girl Rag. And I believe that if you weren't already on your way down to buy tickets to see Blackbird, this song should make you do it. So here's the song.
Don't you know that girl could shake a saint's salvation? Don't you know that girl's a snake who brings temptation? Don't you know she ain't no child? Don't you know she's running wild with her bad girl rag? Don't you know that she's as hot as hell's damnation? Don't you know that she has got a reputation? Don't you know a girl that bold is gonna catch more than a cold with her bad girl rag? Bad girl running in the streets, bad girl passing out her sweets. That cat jumped out of the bag, now it's doing the bad girl rag. Bad girl running with the boys, bad girl using them like toys. Their tails just stand up and wag when she's doing the bad girl rag. Shaking her bottom, tossing her top. Carrie, you gotta get her to stop. Dancing for pennies out on the street, kicking so high that her pussy's got feet.
Don't you think it's time your mouth goes on vacation? Pack your bags and head down south to hell's damnation. Don't you think I've had enough? Go to hell and hop and pop at her bad girl rag.
There's a devil in her soul. Don't be
to see that girl is just a celebration.
Don't you know that girl has got a reputation? How'd she learn that zig and zag?
How'd your titties learn to sag?
Don't get mad, girl.
She's no bad girl.
It's a bad girl rag.
Isn't that adorable? So, you can hear that and more like that. And in fact, I think we're going to go out on one more song from the show. But before I play that, I need to thank, as always, Josh Hackney, my IT guru, who makes sure that the show sounds as good as it can. Teaches me everything I need to know about the computer, electronics, recording, pretty much anything I can think to ask him. And then when I've forgotten how to do it, reminds me again in the gentlest way. So always, as always, if you need help with any of these things, you want Josh Hackney, and you can get him, as you can get me, at my website, thelinshow.com. Just click on Email Me, ask for Josh, ask me anything else. And as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show. something that you learned that you didn't know, something that amused you or intrigued you or motivated you, something that will bring you back because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too. And we're going to go out on yet another song from the adorable, delightful, wonderful Blackbird, the Josephine Baker story. And this is Never Thought I'd Find You.
Never thought I'd find you, wasn't even looking. You ain't what I wanted, you ain't down home cooking.
Never thought I'd find ya, figured you'd be taken. Who thought I'd be craving collard greens and bacon?
Something wild about ya, baby, I don't get ya.
Something in your eyes says better to forget ya.
Josie, you're a darling.
Don't know what you're saying. Eddie, if you knew me, you would start a praying.
Never thought I'd find you when you slipped away. Baby, now I found you. It's my lucky day.
Eddie, gotta warn you, I'm not what you say. I don't wanna scorn you, but I'll never stay.
No, I can't escape ya. No, there's no use trying.
Eddie, I ain't selling.
But baby, Eddie's buying.
This ain't no fire sale.
Won't be so confusing if you let Eddie lead ya.
Josie does the choosing, and Josie doesn't need ya.
Never thought I'd find ya, girl, you're so alone.
I can't be your doggy, I can't be your
love you, princess, marry me.
Eddie, don't talk crazy, I'm just here to play. I can't be your princess, I'll just walk away.
Something wild about you, wild is what I'm feeling. Something in your look is so goddamned appealing.
Don't know if I love you, could be just desire. What a man to handle, you sure stoke my fire.
Never thought I'd find you, but you're here to stay. Never wanna bind you, but you make my day.
Never thought I'd find you, but I do confess. Eddie, I'm not ready. Never will be ready.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night.
Alone, die alone.